This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Whether you're overjoyed at hearing this show, or you're extremely angry at me and at this show for what you've heard, then that is exactly what we set out to do. If you're indifferent, if we haven't stirred you, if we haven't pricked up your interest, if you're just indifferent, then I have failed. Failed miserably, in fact, if that's the way you feel after hearing this show. But tune in again and give me another chance.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Why did Bristol's second oldest church on St Michael's on the Mount burn down? Why was it left in mothballs for 17 years? Yes, the church was unused by the diocese for the past 17 years. Last weekend, it was an inferno with priceless pews, medieval wooden carvings and other artefacts destroyed forever. On Facebook, somebody was pictured wearing a devil mask with the burning church in the background. So are the Church of England here good guardians of our city's heritage? Or are they more concerned, like property speculators, with cutting the best financial deal for their property? Also, as the Investigatory Powers Bill looms and the security services are found guilty this week of mass data trawling illegally for the past 17 years, on the same week, The Intercept publishes its latest investigations into where all this surveillance software, most of it anyway, is coming from and asks, are the people that make surveillance software also able to read everything the government is using it for? Our sister show Dialect is back at noon every Tuesday. This week, his uncle was a director of the Bank of England back in the 1960s and 70s when Britain was booming. So what does Justin Walker from the British Constitution Group have to say about the nation's finances today? And what was his astounding advice his uncle gave him on the train to London when he was a 16-year-old schoolboy? That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can also listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. Well, I'm joined on the line, I hope now, by Diocesan Secretary Oliver Hume. He does financial management and manages a team of 40 people for the Bishop down at the Bristol Diocese. Hi, Oliver, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, this is obviously a horrific disaster, but I wonder, is the diocese actually culpable here, having left this church empty for such a long time?
So what happens when a local church, a parish church, which is run by a parochial church council, decides that it can no longer sustain worship in a church? Is it hands the church over to the diocese, which is the wider body, across an area that supports churches and clergy and so on? And this is actually quite an unusual situation. In Bristol, in the last 16 years, one church has closed as the Church of England Church. That was in Redfield a couple of years ago, and immediately it became used for worship by the Coptic Orthodox Church, which is the Egyptian church, a very persecuted church in Egypt, where more and more Christians are fleeing because they're persecuted. What happened at St Michael and the Mount without in the late 90s was that the congregation was dwindling and effectively walked out on it, leaving the diocese with the challenge of finding a new use for it. Because what happens when a church closes for worship is a diocese with the national church, the church commissioners, needs to find an appropriate use for the future. And over the last 16 or 17 years, that's what we've been trying to do. And there have been a really large number of potential users who have gone into great depth in trying to find out whether they can take it on, whether it's fit for their purposes, and incredibly frustratingly over that period, as each scheme has taken maybe up to 2 or 3 years to come to a kind of final decision, potential users have pulled out. That's been anything from talking to the council about the school taking on the site adjacent to St Michael on the Mount Without. It's been talking to Easy Runner, who is the running shop on St Michael's Hill, who are keen to use it as a sort of almost like a track for selling their shoes. We've been for the last few years working with an independent church who wanted to take it on, but obviously this is a church which is fairly historic. It's a Grade 2 star listed building. It's been on the Heritage at Risk register for some time, and although it's in a good location, the site is quite difficult because of the lack of access around it. So as we've gone, despite making a huge amount of efforts to find a new user, and I must say very few of them would have generated hardly any financial resources for the diocese, this was more about finding an appropriate user, and we've been working with Historic England on that, but that hasn't come to pass, and it's been incredibly frustrating.
Well, has it? I mean, you detected a bit of a pattern here in that proposals are being built up and then falling down, built up and then falling down. I mean, surely you should be learning from this process and making sure something does happen. I mean, 17 years is far too long to leave a place empty like that. I mean, you've got, for example, St John's, I think it's St John the Baptist, isn't it? It's part of the old city wall, which is, I think, the oldest church in the city, which is run by the Church's Conservation Trust. They will move into a church and they'll just kind of keep it open for people that want to wander in, sit down, even meditate or whatever they want to do. Why haven't you done that at St Michael's?
So, I mean, you said earlier that St Michael on the Mount was the second oldest church in the city. It certainly isn't. But Church's Conservation Trust come out of the Church of England, great organisation, but they will only look at Grade 1 listed buildings, and as I said, St Michael on the Mount Without is a Grade 2 star listed building. Although it had some significant heritage features within it, it didn't have the kind of building heritage that the Church's Conservation Trust would be interested in. Of course, we explored it with them. So, as I said, when a church is closed, most churches, and I can give you some examples of the churches that closed in the sort of 80s and 90s, have found uses, generally community uses. So Circa Media took on St Paul's in Portland Square, the Wedding Cake Church. In St Werburgh's, the church there is a climbing centre. St George's Brandon Hill off Park Street, concert hall, and an arts centre. So, you know, we do work very hard and have generally very successful in finding new uses. St Michael on the Mount Without, very sadly, had a number of factors that made it very difficult for churches to take on.
Well, I know there are many, many independent churches in the city, many of them largely from the city's ethnic community, who would grasp the chance to have a permanent space like St Michael's. So why haven't you given it to one of them?
We have tried to, we've been marketing it, as it were, to other independent churches for a long time. And as I said, there is a very disappointed independent church right now who had been working on a scheme for a number of years. But to generate the kind of funds to take on a building of that kind and make it fit for contemporary use is a serious undertaking.
So are you expecting whoever takes it on to also restore it, which is really what you should have done?
The responsibility of the diocese is not to restore a church; it's to pass it on in its condition.
Yeah, but you haven't done that, have you, Oliver?
Our responsibility is to seek a use. We've been working with Historic England for the last 16 years. Our responsibility is to find a new use for it. It's not to restore a church. That's not where a church that's been closed as a Church of England church.
But you haven't, have you?
We haven't found
a new use for it, so you're abrogating your responsibility. I mean, this is what the basic point about why is this building been left empty for so long. I mean, this is right near the city centre, and there are so many community groups, churches, all sorts of people who will be clamouring to have such a place which is so close, maybe theatre groups, all sorts.
As I said, we have explored uses with all of these groups, but none of them want to take it on. None of them have ultimately wanted to take it on. There's a lot of interest, but when you start to think about the heritage aspects, maintaining those, any building works because the burial sites go back to the Black Death. It's adjacent to an ancient hospital. So there are a load of planning issues. So unfortunately, all of the new users, other than the ones that we were exploring with currently, have understood that it's an undertaking that they couldn't make.
What about, say, something like a permanent slave trading museum like Liverpool has, something like that?
You need to find someone who was wanting to start a permanent slave trading museum to take it on. It's not our responsibility to be the new user. It's our responsibility to help find a new user.
Well, it does sound as if maybe what's happening is that you're saying that whoever it is that takes it on is going to have to pay you guys too much in order to restore it back to... And obviously now it's been burnt down. At least there may be some insurance money so you can restore it properly.
It's not the case that they would be paying us a lot. It's a case that in order to make it what they want it to be, they would have to spend money on it. It's a single open space as a building, which requires obviously considerable planning aspects for a heritage building, and therefore any user would be taking that on and need to work through that.
So they're basically having to pay for the fact that you have neglected it for so long. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not the case. The building was in a condition which would have been totally usable until it was burnt down. Someone started a fire deliberately in it.
Also, I mean, I can remember reporting on this show, gosh, when we first started back around about 2009 on St John's Conduit. This was started by the Carmelite friars in the city back in 1267, and in the winter of 1940, during the Blitz, it was used to supply water into the city centre because the main water supplies had been broken down, but the good old conduit was still working. Now, that is also diocesan property, and when Bristol Water came in to do, I think actually may have been Wessex Water, to come and do a load of works in the city centre, that was running for 700 years until recently. Now it's conked out completely. So if we have another blitz in Bristol, that there will be no water for people.
I can't comment on that. That's not something that I know about. It's not owned by the diocese. I can't comment on that.
Well, it is. It was taken over from whoever originally owned it, and it's part of the diocese's responsibility. I can remember reporting on it back all that time. I mean, it just seems that there is a bit of a pattern of neglect here, Oliver. Sorry to say it, but that's what it looks like.
Well, that's, as I said, you might think it is, but it's not part of the diocese's property. It was a closed church which was taken on by someone else. So it's not part of our neglect. As I said, St Michael on the Mount Without is the only closed church in the Bristol Diocese for which we had not found a use. And that tends to be someone else taking on the freehold, where there is a leasehold, for example, St George's Brandon Hill. It is well maintained and so on and so forth. So it's not a pattern of neglect. We've been working with, a site like St Michael, any empty building will attract unwanted attention, and we were working with the police. We were constantly resecuring the site, a regular pattern of inspections. We are obviously devastated by what's happened. It's part of our city's heritage, and that someone would have started a fire, whether deliberately to destroy the place or in a negligent fashion, is hugely disappointing.
Now, I'm not sure you do crystal balls, but if you were looking at your crystal ball, what do you think is going to happen to St Michael's on the Mount now?
Well, obviously, our priority has been to make the site safe, and we've been working with the council, city building control and environmental health for that, and there are no concerns there, but there is work to be done on it. We will continue to work with Historic England to see if what kind of future it might have. We need to meet with our insurers and see what can be done in terms of remedial works. But I can't tell you. It's been hard enough to find a user, as I've been explaining, for the building when it was fully intact. Now it's been so devastated. that's going to be a challenge.
Do you regret not giving it to one of these other people who was wanting to use it now it's in the state it is?
We had no... It was not us not wanting to give it to a potential user. It was potential users not wanting to take it on. That has been the issue in every situation. At no point has the Diocese of Bristol ever turned down a user who wanted to take it on. This has always been users getting cold feet every single time.
Well, that's a great pity. Anyway, let's hope that something does happen with this. Also, we've got coming up next month something that I always report on here, which is the Merchant Venturers Charter Day. Maybe you could just tell us, because there's been a bit of a debacle, hasn't there, over it, this, particularly since Bishop Mike was talking about Edward Colston and speculation about his business dealings. Do you think that one is gone away now, or do you think we'll still have some... problems with the bishop being accused of giving some kind of credence to this idea that Edward Colston wasn't a slave trader or wasn't a bad chap?
I can't imagine why he would be that idea would be promoted. I'm not. Oh, obviously, if people want to make an issue of this situation, that is up to them. Bristol has a past that it needs to come to terms with. It has figures in our past who have been complicit with the slave trade, and we need to come to terms with that. In terms of what people say about the bishop and what he might say or might have said, which was, as far as I can work out, largely misreported, that's up to them. I can't predict what they might be saying, but I don't think he will be saying anything that would in any way justify anyone to do with the slave trade.
I mean, is the text of what he said is pretty clear. He was talking about the morality of Edward Colston's business dealings, and in twice he actually said that there was speculation about it. Well, that does sound, doesn't it, like he's saying that the his connection with the slave trade, there was some kind of speculation there.
The Bishop of Bristol is very clear that Edward Colston had a connection with the slave trade. He's been very clear about that.
So why is he telling hundreds of school children then that it's speculation?
I can't comment on that because this is a few years ago and I haven't got the text in front of me. And
I suppose, to be fair, I should ask you how long you've been in the job, because this may have been before you started.
I've been in the job for 2 years.
Well, anyway, let's hope something happens with the St. Michael's Hill Church and that some useful purpose is found for it. It seems almost criminal that such beautiful buildings are left in our city centre with nothing happening to them for such a long time. And Oliver Hume, you are Diocesan Secretary, looking after management of a team of 40 people for the Bishop. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you, Tony.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Now I'm joined in the studio by Christine Townsend and also by Dr. Roger Ball from Bristol Radical History Group. I just wonder, Christine, firstly from you, what you make of what you've just heard there.
What about St. Michael on the Mount, the church, or...?
Particularly on what we heard about the speculation over Edward Colston, because, I mean, it does seem that Oliver Wood's taking over as a diocesan secretary, more or less, as we had all this the revelations 2 years ago about what had been being said to these school children in the church.
I'm sure that Oliver has read a number of the press cuttings, because it was quite big 2 years ago after the bishop was recorded surreptitiously in the cathedral saying what he was saying to the children. I find it interesting that Oliver says that we need to come to terms with the past. I would suggest that the cathedral needs to come to terms with the past, and they need to present Edward Colston to children or anybody else that they're talking to about Edward Colston for the slave trader that he was. You can't continue to repeat that the man was a philanthropist, but not also then fill in all the other gaps around what else the man did and where that money came from.
I suppose the other aspect here, of course, is the merchant venturers' control of many of our schools, and certainly influence on the governing bodies of them too.
Oh yeah, the Merchant Venturers, we know, are sponsors of a number of academies. They sponsor Colston Girls' School. They sponsor the Merchants Academy, which were two of the state schools that were in the cathedral on that day, where the children were going to school. But members of the Merchant Venturers also sit on the cathedral charter, and you know they're involved with St Mary Redcliffe. They're very good friends with the Diocese of Bristol and Pete and the Bishop and the Dean. Let's put it that way.
Now, also know that you've been involved in a sort of letter-writing campaign and negotiations over trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again. The idea that hundreds of schoolchildren, by the way, the Evening Post completely wrongly reported it, or the Bristol Post, whatever they like to call themselves, saying there were scores of schoolchildren. Well, I was in there at the time, and there were hundreds of schoolchildren. The place was absolutely packed with school kids. The point really being that these children don't have any options to whether to be there or not, and there they are being lectured on history by the bishop in error.
Yeah, well, the parents would have to sign a form to say that presumably they're allowed to go to this particular trip on the charter day, but those children have no choice over what the bishop chooses to say to them. Also, you know, after the ceremony, they'll all be offered a bun named after Edward Colston, and then that pictures are taken of the children throwing the buns in the air, and then those pictures are used on newsletters for the school and website promotional material. So even if the children didn't necessarily listen to every word that the bishop said to them, they'll certainly want to have that Colston bun, and that's kind of the point, really, for me, is the way in which it's presented. And giving children cakes, I think, is actually really very underhand.
Well, I mean, the children won't say so. They'll probably say it's great. But in a way, it's kind of PR, isn't it? It's a sort of PR exercise for the merchants, a kind of whitewashing exercise for Edward Colston.
Well, I would agree. And the merchants are in there with them as well. And it's part of some kind of initiation ceremony, I'm going to almost suggest that it is, as part of becoming what it is to be part of civil life in Bristol. And you're very lucky, and it's a very special event, and you should be privileged to have been invited to this particular event. Well, I'm interested to know what the schools, A, tell the parents about what's actually going on, and B, the education that the children get around it, because if that's what's happening, if that's the only time they're getting a cake about Edward Colston, I know I've taught children for a long time, that's the bit they remember.
One of the questions that I know you've asked in the letter you've publicly published now that you sent, I think it was to the Dean, maybe you could just tell us what the main points you were in there.
Well, what we've asked really for the Dean is to let publicly publish what it is that they're actually going to do this year, because they've agreed to make some concessions, because the Dean, when we met with him, denied any knowledge that he was aware that Colston buns were being given to the children, which I find amazing.
But surely, look, the main thing here is the text of what the bishop is saying to these school children. These school children are being told something by the bishop, and yet he seems that he wants to keep it secret. He wants to keep everybody out of the church. Doesn't it sound like normal kind of cathedral practice?
Put some flesh on that, what that actually means from a historical point of view. I mean, there is this kind of perception that the story of Edward Colston is a story which is difficult to analyse historically, that the evidence isn't really there, that nobody quite knows where Colston got his money from, and that somehow he may or may not have been involved in the slave trade. Well, to be honest, from, you know, having studied the sources, that's complete nonsense, really, what the bishop said, that there was speculation. Let's get it straight about with Colston, right? We're not just talking about somebody who made a lot of money out of the slave trade in the 17th century in particular. We're talking about somebody who actually was the second in command of the most important organisation in the British Empire for the trading of slaves, which was the Royal African Company. So Colston wasn't some bit player. He wasn't somebody who just invested in slavery or put some money in at some point in his life. Edward Colston ran the slave trade for Britain. He was in that position in the 1680s and 1690s in the Royal African Company. So it's very important to get that straight. A lot of people made money out of the slave trade, including Edward Colston. But Edward Colston ran it. And that's the point. And that's why Edward Colston is a major, major issue in this city. You know, I think there's a famous book written in the 1920s which first kind of exposed Edward Colston by Reverend Wilkins. And he made the point in that book that there were hundreds of people who should have been remembered as being the city fathers and city mothers rather than Edward Colston. And he actually brought to the surface this strange cult, almost fetish, around Edward Colston to the exclusion of all these other people who've done great things in the city. And for that, he was actually targeted by a lot of the great and the good in the city, the wealthy, after he wrote that book. But that was the first time it really started to break into the public domain that really Edward Colston is not someone who should be celebrated. In fact, there were lots of other people who should be.
So was it just the slave trade that he was involved in?
No, he traded in lots of goods, but the key bit where he made his money was in two ways, really. One was through slave trading, but he then took that money and acted as a money lender. So, for example, he was invited to join the merchant ventures in Bristol in the 1680s after he'd made a £2,000 loan to the city corporation. So he was somebody who had significant banking power, in a sense, or money lending power, and he multiplied the money that he made out of the slave trade through lending, and quite a ruthless money lender as well.
Why is he such a sort of almost cult like father? I agree with you. It's just sort of pictures of him everywhere, and the idea is to try and turn this person who is profiting from human misery into someone who's like one of the greatest people in history. Why is that happening?
Well, I think there are two things we can grab here. One of them we're researching at the moment, a team of us are actually researching, and there's this very, very curious anomaly about Edward Colston. So Edward Colston was involved in two organisations at the same time. So he was deputy governor of the Royal African Company, which had a monopoly on the slave trade. That meant that they were the only ones that could trade, and there were sort of a couple of hundred investors, you know, very wealthy investors involved in it. Meanwhile, all around the country, organisations such as the Merchant Ventures wanted to get their finger into the pie of this vile trade, and they campaigned publicly for 20 years against the Royal African Company, the Merchant Ventures, to get into this slave trade. They wanted to break it open, break the monopoly, and make so they could make a lot of money. And it's very strange that Edward Colston could be in both camps at the same time. In fact, he eventually left the Royal African Company and joined the other side. So there's a lot of speculation now, and it is speculation because the evidence is not...
This is the correct use of the word, Bishop Mike.
this is exactly. There is speculation about the fact that maybe Edward Colston was a very, very useful person for the people, for the merchant venturers, in terms of like uncovering what the Royal African Company were up to and how they could undermine them, which they did, because in 1698, the Royal African Company lost its monopoly. We wonder whether Colston had something to do with that. And then after that, the number of slaves that were being shipped in Britain went up by a factor of five, and a small number of wealthy people in Bristol made an awful lot of money out of the slave trade. So we wonder whether they kind of fate, you know, they, you know, their fetishes Edward Colston, because he made them extremely rich. That's one suggestion. The second suggestion is that the city needed a figure, the great and the good in the city needed a figure to unite the city, particularly in the late 19th century, when you had mass demonstrations, strikes, you had the cavalry set on the streets to break up all these demonstrations of people who wanted democracy and socialism. So there was an attempt to try and unify the city around what people like the merchant venturers regarded as somebody who was respectable, and that was Edward Colston. So that statue you see down in the centre, that was put up in 1895. It's very recent. It's not some old bit of architecture. It's something very recent that was put there by the wealthy in Bristol.
What about this fact, Roger, that the merchant venturers today have got this immunity from having to publish accounts, being under a royal charter? Because it does, you know, doesn't really sit very well with an organisation which has so much power and owns so much land in the city, for them to not to have to do the basic things that most ordinary business people would have to.
Well, that's right, and it's a kind of strange connection between sort of the idea of the corporation and, you know, the rights that come around with the charter that protect these people, and so they're able to move in a sense behind a sort of veil. And I think, you know, with all organisations that claim to have some kind of civic power responsibility, they need to be completely transparent. I mean, that's obvious. So, as far as I'm concerned, I'd like to see the merchant ventures wound up. They probably should have been wound up several hundred years ago.
Well, they probably would disagree with that. But what about this move into things like education? This is a more modern thing. But also, of course, we've got merchant ventures at the helm of our two big National Health Service trusts, which spend around about a billion pounds £1,000 of our public money every year?
Well, I mean, first of all, as I said, just from a historical point of view, I find it an embarrassment that such an organisation still exists, like, considering the role they played in promoting the slave trade and making money out of it. That's my first point. But regardless of that, how the hell they could get involved in the rest of this is a mystery to me. Like, but maybe Christine could comment on that. She's a bit more of an expert on that than me.
Well, I became interested in the Merchant Venturers because as a teacher, I was teaching at the academy where the Merchant Venturer became the chair, the first academy in Bristol. And since then, look, they officially sponsor two other academy trusts, but they're also involved in other academies. And the idea that you can have individual merchant venturers and the merchant venturers as an organisation running our schools, yet we don't know what they invest in, I find very, very disturbing. I want to know what the merchant venturers as an organisation are investing their money in, because if they're investing their money in securities or arms and weapons, as we might otherwise know them as, then I don't think they're fit people to be running schools. I don't think they're fit people to be running hospitals, and they need to open their books. It's only the Privy Council that are in a position to actually look at the financial accounts of the merchant venturers, because they've got this royal charter, and transparency has got to be the way in which we as members of the public and taxpayers understand who's running our public services.
Well, they are, to a certain extent, transparent once a year, aren't they, when they come down to the cathedral, troop in and troop out again, and bring all those school children with them to hear a lecture from the bishop. Surely there is any group of people, merchant ventures or anybody, have got every right to get together and organise.
I think the point about it is that there's a difference between open and democratic forms of organisation in the city around, you know, as I said, issues around civic power and the way the city's represented. And I don't think this organisation is open or democratic. So I don't think it should be taken on any of that role, regardless of getting involved in education. I mean, I know that, you know, there's an attempt to try and privatise education or open the free market in education. But I don't think that these people should really be involved in that, especially considering they're somewhat checkered history.
Christine, surely everybody has a right to get together, to form an organisation, to meet, to do what they want. Effectively, I mean, what you're saying in a way is that there's anti-democratic. It's Roger that said it, that the merchant venturers shouldn't be allowed to exist in their present form. What do you make of that?
From a personal level, I've got no issue with, you know, old men getting together and having dinner somewhere, okay? The issue I have is that these are individuals, and as a group, they are in massively powerful positions within the city, and therefore within the country as well, because they've also got these huge links with London, and I would imagine the rest of the country, other parts of the country. That's the issue I have with it. And when it becomes that these people also have control over how our public money is spent, and how our children are educated, and how our health services run, then it does become everybody's business, because these are services that we pay for as taxpayers.
Thursday the 10th of November is this year, but it's the 10th of November every year, Roger. I mean, they're out in the open. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that you have to challenge these things. I mean, you certainly have to challenge the question about celebrations of Edward Colston. I mean, in our negotiations with the cathedral and with Colston Girls' School, for example, over the commemoration day, one of the issues that came up is that we've got a cathedral making a statement. The dean made a statement that that they would not in any way countenance a celebration of someone like Edward Colston. Yet at the same time, they're having their own in the cathedral themselves. They have these days, and it was very clear. I mean, the head of Colston Girls School made it very clear in a letter to parents last year that actually this was a celebration of Edward Colston. So we've got a lot of confusion here, and I think that's the point, is that we've got to come out in the open now and clear this up. You know, is it right to go around celebrating somebody who was involved directly in organising the slave trade? And isn't it time to move on? And, you know, this is not some kind of let's wreck Bristol. I've lived here most of my life now. And, you know, I there's a lot of people in this city who want to see some changes around things like that. And there are some great historical figures in the city's history that are completely lost and have been smothered by the image of Edward Colston.
OK, Roger, go for it. Who would you like to see celebrated more in the city?
Well, I'd start with changing the the name of the Colston Hall, right, to Wolfston Hall, after St. Wolfston. He was the patron saint of peasants and vegetarians. But what is he famous for? He's coming to Bristol in the 11th century, he raised the Bristol mob, and he stopped the slave trade in the city. At the time, there was a whole load of slave trading with Ireland going on. And,
this is,
you know,
the white slave trade.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. The merchant ventures weren't choosy. I'll come on to that in a minute. But you know, the point about it is that these great figures like St. Wolfston, he's hardly remembered. I know a historian in Bristol, Mark Steeds, has been working on this for years, on publicising St. Wolfston and his great job in stopping the slave trade in the 11th century. I mean, to be honest, he did the preaching and the mob did the doing. So the Bristol mob went round, dragged out the major slave traders and put their eyes out. And that's what stopped the trade in the 11th century. Now, I believe some organisations of merchants reintroduced it after that, and particularly in the 17th century. And people like the merchant ventures were involved in that, and that was a trade in basically grabbing anybody they could in society and putting them to work in their plantations in Virginia. Tobacco, I believe, was what they were making. And so in that period, you know, it was any old Bristolian. If you were a vagrant, if you were an orphan, if you were somebody who was vulnerable, a prisoner, if you're a prisoner of war, anybody could get their hands on. If they could get them, they'd be either indentured or forced labourers put out into their plantations. And you can see why they got so excited about somebody like Edward Colston, who was helping to break open the slave trade, you know, from the monopoly in London. That's the West African slave trade, because they could get a whole lot more labour down there. So people who challenged this are very important. We've got St. Wolfston originally. Another candidate is Thomas Clarkson, the great abolitionist who came down to Bristol in 1787, hung out in the Seven Stars pub, if you know it, down on Thomas Lane near Bristol Bridge, tied up with all the sailors down there, and found out what the content of the actual slave trade was from the mouths of those people who didn't support it, the sailors who had to work on those ships, most of whom were forced labourers themselves. So there were great figures in, you know, Bristol's history we could remember, and rather than Edward Colston. And there's some great Bristolians in the history of the abolitionist slave trade as well.
This letter that's been published, which is really making some demands, demanding the publish the acknowledgements and proposed changes, outlined in a letter. We wanted to know what changes you're going to make to the arrangements between the cathedral and the merchant venturers, publishing the service plans, sermon texts and prayers 2 weeks beforehand so that people can have a look, see what the bishop is about to say, and also permit independent witnesses to observe the ceremonies and see that those plans and texts are closely followed. Really, it's a kind of breakdown in trust with what the cathedral get up to with these hundreds of school children on charter day in the cathedral. Signing the letter is Dr. Roger Ball. That's you, Roger. Also, Katie Finnegan Clark, Councillor Cleo Lake, Rosalind Martin, Dr. Ben Pritchett, Mark Steeds, and you, Christine. So can you just tell us a bit about some of the other people that have signed this, Robin?
Well, we're a group that came together a year ago or so, just over a year ago, to first of all look into the issue around the celebration of Edward Colston in the cathedral. That's where we started. We've done an awful lot of historical research since then. Like, for example, Mark Steeds in particular has been compiling a Colston casebook, which is to kind of mark all the different organisations, buildings, streets, paraphernalia in Bristol that's named after Edward Colston. Also, we've been doing a lot of research into Colston's history just so we can get it straight and clear up a lot of the confusion that there's been, or the attempts to try and whitewash his involvement.
Can I just ask you what sort of source material you've got for this? This is a long time ago.
Yeah, well, we've started with secondary sources. That's what people have written, so we've been through all of that. Now, for the last few months, we've been working on primary sources, both in the National Archive but also in the Bristol Record Office as well. So we're trying to get back to the original documents and trying to uncover something which I think a lot of historians, you know, at the end of the day, they probably haven't looked at the original documents, but we have.
What about some of the other figures here? Katie Finnegan Clark?
Katie Finnegan Clark is one of the group who's been involved in organising the website and recently, but she's actually an ex-pupil of Colston Girls' School. There are a number of pupils we've come across over the years, ex-pupils, including Cleo Lake, I believe, as well, who have been very, you know, not been happy with the way that the school has presented itself to them as pupils, and how it's presented it to, is continued to present the school to the, you know, the history of the school to the pupils since then. So it's been great to work together with different people from different parts of Bristol. You know, we've got to know each other through this activity. But I think the key thing about this is really to get down to the nitty-gritty. I mean, one example of this is that there have been some concessions by the cathedral about the ceremony, the commemoration day for Colston Girls' School. But, you know, some of these things are a little bit lily-livered, to be honest. I mean, one thing, it was said that if the philanthropic history of Edward Colston was mentioned, then they would balance that by talking about the slave trade. Well, to be honest, I can tell you that in the time that Edward Colston was involved in the Royal African Company, 120,000 slaves were transported across the Atlantic, and of them, about 20-odd thousand died and were thrown overboard in terrible conditions. Most of them were branded, packed very tightly. That's one of the innovations that Colston and his managers organised. So I don't quite see how we can balance philanthropy with kind of mass murder. So I don't really think that's really acceptable. I think really Colston's got to leave the stage of history in terms of being commemorated or memorialised. Now, one of the arguments that's thrown at us a lot is that we're erasing history. Well, that's complete nonsense. I mean, if I want to go and find out about Bristolian abolitionists, I ain't going to find many statues in this city. But what I might need to do is go to the library, and that's where we spend a lot of our time. And I think stopping memorialising Colston and commemorating him is not a problem. If you want to find out about Colston in the future, go and look where history is, and that's in the books.
Well, on the one of the jingles, which is played on this station for quite a lot, there's George Ferguson saying he's predicting that the Colston Hall will not be named after Edward Colston by 2015 or something, round about then. But obviously he hasn't actually got the name changed, has he?
Well, no, and I'm sure if Ferguson was involved in it, it'd probably end up being called the Carphone Warehouse Hall or the Vodafone Hall or something. So, you know, the point about this is a great opportunity. If the Colston Hall's name is going to change, which is what we hear, it'd be a great opportunity for Bristol to really make its mark here. And I think Wolston Hall would be wonderful.
What about the legacy of Cabot as well, Roger? Because this man was financed. We actually had the university professor from the Cabot project up at Bristol University on this show earlier this year talking about all this. And he was saying, well, look, although the merchant venturers were formed something like 60, 70 years after John Cabot's voyage, they were the same families, the same people that were behind that voyage. Now, that led to a genocide of, some say, up to 100 million Native Americans, maybe, as other estimates, 75 million Native Americans. So it seems that this is another side of Bristol, which a lot of people are a little bit uncomfortable about looking at, whether John Cabot was actually some kind of good guy or not, effectively doing a kind of reconnaissance for a mass genocide.
Well, yeah, I think that's it's a good point. I mean, the thing with Cabot is there is a kind of connection between the two, funnily enough, which kind of which is to do with Brandon Hill. I mean, I don't know if you're aware, before obviously Brandon the Cabot Tower in Brandon Hill was put in the 19th century, but I believe that the kind of lobby from Clifton of the wealthy was they wanted actually a colossus of Edward Colston on Brandon Hill. According to the sources,
what a sort of 500-foot-high Edward Colston,
a bit like Rio de Janeiro sort of thing. That sort of thing, I believe, because obviously Brandon Hill overlooks the whole city. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the point of view, we ended up with Cabot Tower. But no, Cabot is an issue as well, absolutely. And I think one of the problems is that, you know, there are some great heroes in Bristol's history that we really need to popularise now, and not colonial expanders, colonial drug dealers, or colonial slave owners.
Drug dealing? Surely not.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I was going to target certain groups of wealthy people in Britain in the 19th century in particular, in the 18th, who basically made huge amounts of money out of nefarious activities and then gave it back maybe to the city to big up their egos, or to, you know, name things after them.
Well, to bribe them to keep them quiet.
Well, that's right. Colston certainly threw some money about in Bristol. But, one of the big issues is the drug dealers of the 19th century involved in the Opium Wars. That's basically where Britain took opium from India and fed it into China. China tried to stop that happening, and there was a war. We beat them up, and then we got, as a result, 16 million Chinese opium addicts, which made us some some very rich people in Britain, much, much richer.
So was Bristol in any way connected with that?
I'm not an expert on in Bristol, but you certainly find examples all around the country. I mean, for example, I believe the Isle of Lewis in Scotland was bought by one of these drug dealers who then turfed out 3,000 Scottish crofters, made them build roads and then transported them to America before he built his castle on the island and took it up.
I wonder whether you're going to get taught that at the Merchants Academy.
I don't think you will. And drug dealing is not high on the agenda in most schools in terms of history, but it should be, because it is a clue to a lot of the British colonial past and where money comes from. So we haven't even started with the drug dealers. Maybe we'll start with the slave traders and get on to the drug dealers next.
This is one of the aspects of this which really bothers me, is that when you've got merchant venturers running schools, they're not likely to have on the curriculum any kind of academic material which is really showing them up historically as being exactly who they are, which is effectively tyrants.
Well, I think the problem is that they will have some stuff on the history curriculum dealing with slave trade, but the issue which is important is how much it relates to this city and to organisations like the Merchant Ventures. I think you're right, quite right. I doubt they'll be popularising Edward Colston as a slave trader, or that the Merchant Ventures were directly involved in it. I mean, one thing about Colston, he's a figurehead and certainly fated and a fetish for these people, but I think much more important is we have to look at the organisations such as the Merchant Ventures historically, who had a much bigger part to play in the slave trade than Edward Colston did in the long term.
Now, I'll ask you both this. You first, Christine. What would you like to see happen with, number one, the Merchant Ventures, and two, with their big annual ceremony coming up in a couple of weeks, the Charter Day at the Cathedral?
With the Merchant Venturers, I want them to open their books. I want them to publish their accounts so that we as taxpayers and members of the public are able to view how it is and where it is that they hold their money, so that we can be confident in them as sponsors of schools and as you know, people running our hospitals, that they do have the best interests of people at heart, as opposed to their own capitalist endeavours to make themselves money.
Well, hang on, because right on this very show, George Ferguson said that the Merchant Ventures give back much more to this city, and he's an ex-merchant venturer himself, he should know, than they take.
Well, that's great. So let's see the books so that we're able to see the evidence and judge for ourselves. You know, it's all very well being told by George Ferguson or anybody else that is or was a member of the Merchant Ventures that this is what they actually do. But until you see the evidence, I'm afraid I'm going to continue to say that they need to open their books. The second question about the cathedral... the cathedral just needs to go back to their scriptures, I think, and, you know, ask themselves, would Jesus be giving buns to children that are named after a slave trader? And if the answer to that is no, then they need to check themselves and they need to do some serious reflection about what it is, the messages that they're actually putting out, and whose history they are allowing to be reproduced in that cathedral on that day.
Because it does seem that it's a kind of private hire and the whole place is sealed off for this. I mean, when I managed to get in a couple of years ago to record what was going on, there were several attempts to eject me, and they had almost like a kind of like polite female security team going around making sure that nobody was allowed into the cathedral who didn't have some kind of check off by them.
Well, then they're clearly nervous, aren't they, about what's going on behind closed doors. And you've got children in there, you've got state-funded schools in there. What have you got to hide? If you've got nothing to hide and everything is legit and everything is above board, then open the doors, open your books, and let's see what's going on. If there's nothing to hide, there's nothing to hide.
Maybe we could broadcast a service. We'll offer to do that, in fact, for free here on BCFM.
Absolutely, yeah.
We can broadcast it. So if you put your money where your mouth is, folks, and come and put it on the radio, your wonderful service with these hundreds of school children. Anyway, Roger, what about to you? What would you like to see happen with the merchant venturers? I know you think that they should be closed, but I mean, these people would have to do something, maybe some alternative to the charter that they're now operating under. And then your thoughts about what should be happening in the cathedral.
Well, I mean, I remember in 2007, which was the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade, abolition 200 if you remember it, and I was at a televised debate where a person was asked a question in the audience, or they were asking a question. There was the question being, what do you think the legacy of the abolition 200 years should be? And that person said quite correctly that, you know, what the merchant venturers should do is disband their organisation on the anniversary, 200th anniversary of the abolition of slave trade, and whatever money they've got is to pile it all together. It was 93 million quid at the time, it was suggested, and that money should be sent back to the Caribbean to build schools and hospitals. So, that's where I stand in the Merchant Ventures. I think their organisation is, as I said, several hundred years out of date. It should shut itself down, disband itself, and put the money somewhere useful. So I'm a bit more serious about it than just opening the book. So I think it's important to see what these organisations are doing. On the front of what should happen about Edward Colston, well, I believe that the statue itself, for example, should be taken to a place of safety, that's into a museum, so that people can see in the future, you know, the strange quirks of British imperial history, where slave traders can be feted in the middle of cities and held up as great examples of people. I think the Colston Hall should be renamed, the Walston Wolston Hall, and then Massive Attack play a massive opening gig there, because they won't play there until the name's changed. And I'd like to see other names of streets and buildings and organisations change, so that we don't really remember Edward Colston, but remember great Bristolians who've done something good in the past.
You mentioned a website. Where can people find this? And maybe you'd like to recommend some books if people are interested in the history here.
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, a good one to start with, which talks a lot about Bristol's history and its relationship to the slave trade from a socio-historical point of view, and really uncovers, you know, how a bunch of grubby merchants made themselves extremely rich and powerful people, is Mads Dresser's Slavery Obscured, which is a really great book. So I definitely recommend that if you can get a hold of it. Get it from the library, got a second hand shops. But so Slavery Obscured by Mads Dresser is a really good place to start. There are a number of pamphlets and bits and pieces produced by the Historical Association about Edward Colston and slave trade, but I would start with Mads's book, because it tells you all about Bristol and how that class of people came to power.
And website?
Website is, well, for Bristol Relic History Group is www.brh.org.uk, and there's also the Counter Colston site, Countering Colston site, which has been opened quite recently, which contains a lot of our research, and you can find that at...
Just Google.
Well, I tell you what, I'll put a link to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. If you go there, I'll make sure that there's a link to there. So, Dr. Roger Ball and Christine Townsend, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show tonight.
Cheers.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
But our final item tonight, it's this chap whose uncle was a director of the Bank of England back in the 1960s and 70s. His name is Justin Walker, and you can hear more from him next Tuesday at noon on The Dialect Show.
My name's Justin Walker, and I suppose my journey started back in 1972, a long time ago. I was going back to school, I was on a train, I was with my uncle, and he was Sir Harry Pilkington, later Lord Pilkington, and he went to the very first Bilderberg conference in 1954. I didn't know that until only a few years ago. But I did know he was the director of the Bank of England from 1955 to 1972. And this was 1972, and he was actually going back. He was travelling down to London to go to one of his last meetings at the Bank of England. And we were just talking about general subjects when he suddenly stopped me dead and said, what are you doing when you leave school? And I was only 16, and I was going down to do my O-levels and stuff. And he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice to take through life. First of all, never believe anything you read in the press, because we control it. And secondly, never ever believe a politician when they say they can do something, because they can't unless we say they can. So, to put it bluntly, that most of that just went right over my head, but you remembered that conversation. So, years to come, I joined the Green Party because I was influenced by people like Jack Cousteau and David Attenborough and all the people who, you know, at that time, Peter Scott, saying that the ecology of the world was being damaged and we had to, you know, humanity had to give nature a chance, and we had to come up with political ideas to help the environment, and I certainly, it all sounded very sensible to me. And I joined the Ecology Party, as it was then, back in 19... 1977, 78 I joined. Well, I kept thinking to myself, well, how is it that we are allowing the corporate world, the big business, to basically dominate the affairs of humanity? Now, I became, as you know, Tony, as I first met you, I became involved in the 9/11 truth movement. And we realized that the war on terror was completely bogus, and we've been analyzing all that. But it was about 5 years ago, almost now, I got a phone call out of the blue from somebody who said that he was a, well, he was his son, actually. It was his son talking to me, because he said his father was extremely elderly. And he said that his father had been a director of the Bank of England with my uncle. And he, not long for this world, but he wanted to tell me one word for me to research. And if I did, I would find all the answers to Britain's economic woes.
What was that word? Well, the word was Bradbury, and it's the Bradbury Pound. That's all we've got time for there, though. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialect on Tuesday at noon. Thanks to Christine Townsend and Roger Ball. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.